You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
'Tis the season for making lists, and Discover Magazine has been busy at work compiling the top 100 science stories of 2010. They range from the disastrous, the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, to the sublime, hints that there's another universe, from the mundane, yes, we're all still too fat, and the planet is getting hotter, to the almost unbelievable, do rocks really propel themselves across the desert? Joining me now to go over some of the more interesting stories on the list is Discover Magazine's editor-in-chief, Corey Powell. Welcome back to our show.
Well, thank you. It's a lot of fun to be here.
For the purposes of this list, what qualifies as a science story? I was thinking about the miner rescue in Chile, and it turns out, has a lot of science involved, but we weren't thinking about it as a science story.
Right. I mean, there were a few stories on the list that kind of fell into that category. I mean, the number one story on our list is the BP oil spill, which is obviously, I'd say overtly it's a failure of technology more than it's a science story. But what's interesting there, as with the Chilean miner story, is that there's science all over the periphery, and there's stories that have significant scientific fallout, both in terms of what we're going to do next and and what actually guided the response.
I was thinking about the BP oil spill as your first choice. Was there any push to make the first item something a bit more positive?
Well, of course, there are commercial considerations, and there are just sort of our own scientists tend to be kind of knee-jerk optimists, and so there's always some pushback when you pick a pessimistic story as your number one story. In this case, I thought the fallout, sort of what it's going to do in terms of energy policy, energy research, the technology of deep drilling. The impact of it is so huge, we couldn't really walk away from it.
Well, maybe you should add as a category naughty and another one nice. But when you're talking about impact, there's also just the impact on the environment. We have no idea what the long-term impact is going to be.
Right. And I mean, in a very grim sense, that the BP oil spill is a huge science experiment. We learned that a lot of that oil stays in midwaters. It never actually makes it to the surface. We learned that there are a lot of natural bacteria in the Gulf that eat the oils that seep out from the ocean bottom all the time, and that's actually helping us. So there's sort of good and bad news there, and a tremendous amount of unknown, which to me was the most interesting thing about it, is just how little we understand about what goes on in the oceans.
And I hate to make predictions, but do you think that the spill will intensify green energy development?
Well, I think usually when you're a monthly magazine, you're chasing way, way behind deadlines because radio and internet can jump on things in a minute that take us a month or two to get on.
Do you want me to apologize?
Oh no, not at all. I am actually quite envious. But in this case, I feel like we're chasing a story whose timescale is so much longer than what we're doing. Yes, there will be a move toward green energy, but it's on a 10, 20, 30-year timescale.
Well, gas prices are climbing. Some predict $5 a gallon within a year. Is it realistic to expect that we as a nation will be able to curb our dependence on petroleum in the near term?
Oh, we'll do it when when there's a significant political will or when there's a significant economic will, and the two will go hand in hand. It's not as if we don't know how to cut oil consumption. The problem is that it's inconvenient and it's expensive.
And the alternatives, like making oil into some kind of gasoline, actually seems to be counterproductive.
Well, yeah. So, there are some fairly straightforward things you could do. The electric grid uses very little petroleum. It's natural gas. It's coal. It's nuclear and hydropower. If you significantly electrified your automobile fleet, you could largely eliminate petroleum. But again, batteries don't give you great range. Batteries are expensive. There are inconveniences involved in doing it.
And then many people suggest nuclear power, but there are problems there with storing all of the spent fuel.
I mean, nuclear power is very exciting. I think there's going to be a lot of move there, but I think most of that movement is going to be actually outside of the United States, where there's not already an established nuclear infrastructure and where the regulatory climate is very different.
In Europe, people pay a lot of money for petroleum because of taxes, but the sense here is that there'll never be the political will to pass a real gas tax in this country.
Right. And
people do go to New Jersey because the taxes are a little lower than they are in New York State.
I know. I mean, people are a little bit crazy about gasoline. You know, they'll drive 20 miles to pay, you know, 2 cents a gallon less for gas. There's a weird psychological barrier. But, you know, market mechanisms will do whatever taxation doesn't do.
Aren't your particular areas of interest physics and astronomy?
They are. You might say I'm a lapsed astronomer. I actually spent a year working for NASA at the Goddard Space Flight Center until I discovered that there were scientific stories that I loved to tell, but that I could not actually do myself.
Well, does it make you partial to those kinds of stories? When the staff was voting on the different stories that would be included, 100 is kind of inclusive, so I guess it weren't the kinds of problems it would have been if you only had 10. But did they break down along specialties? Are there people who primarily were interested in and knowledgeable about lobbying for more stories about biology or chemistry, you about astronomy or physics?
Oh, yes. So that's the great fun of doing a list like this, is that you strip right down to some of the core debates over whether the most exciting thing about science is expanding the human intellect and expanding our sense of our place in the universe, or if the most exciting thing about science is, you know, curing cancer, you know, dealing with immediate practical problems of human welfare.
There's also the problem of we really can't always know whether something that was published this year will have any significance down the line. Joe Palca this morning reported on Morning Edition that 7 years ago a paper was published. Nobody paid any attention to it. That scientist won the Nobel Prize this year. It was on something involving carbon, thin layers of carbon.
Right. It's called graphene, and it's basically sheets of carbon that are now being touted as, you know, the material of the future. But you're right. 7 years ago, it was the material of not getting published and not getting tenure. We've been doing lists like this for almost 30 years, and when I go back and look at past lists, yeah, there's always that feeling of, you know, some story was number 99 turned out to be incredibly important. Some story that was number 10 was a flash in the pan.
But the reason I ask is also you mentioned just a few moments ago that there's always a debate over whether the practical is more important than the theoretical. But sometimes the theoretical turns out to have more applications than the thing we thought was practical in the first place.
Sure. I mean, there's some things here which I think it's safe to say are not going to have practical implications anytime soon. And the search for Earth-like planets around other stars, which to me is one of the most exciting things happening in science, I doubt we're going to be colonizing those things anytime soon. They're, you know, 30, 40, 50 light years away. But imagine finding another Earth-like planet. And imagine even further finding a chemical signature that indicates there could be life there.
Well, the only way we even know that there are planets is we've never seen a planet, right? We only see the effect of a planet as it passes by a star?
Pretty much.
Would an Earth-like planet be large enough to even cast a shadow or whatever it is, or cause enough of a flicker to matter? We're a pretty small planet, aren't we?
Right. So, yeah, and what you see is, you know, if you basically, you look at a readout of a, you know, it's a little squiggly line that tells you how much light you're getting from the star, and there's a teeny tiny little drop in that squiggle. And, you know, if you look at the actual data, it looks like nothing. But then you go to an astronomer, and they can extract an extraordinary story from that little squiggle.
And we have discovered now that there are these planets that move backward, exoplanets.
Right. Part of why I find the whole story of planets around other stars so exciting is that it is a quintessential example of just the capacity of nature to surprise us. Every expectation we had that, you know, we thought we knew the parameters of what was out there, and then it turns out that nature had other ideas.
But why would we assume that they would only move in one direction in the first place? Could it be that the planets in our solar system are moving backward, that it would be normal to move in the other direction?
Well, as with so much in science, you know, we start from sort of a position of ignorance. We have one example to go from, and when there's one example, everyone assumes, okay, well, if this is our one example, that's how everything must be. So there were all these theoretical models. The planets move the same direction. The sun rotates. There's a physical reason for that. This must be the only way it can work. There's a certain way that a planetary system must be constructed. All those things turned out to be completely wrong.
And spell check doesn't recognize the word exoplanet yet.
It does not. It shows up a little red squiggle on my computer every single time.
My guest is Corey Powell, editor-in-chief of Discover Magazine. We're talking about the top 100 sciences, or circling around them in a way. Some of the stories sound a little sci-fi, like the dark flow that Alexander Kuklinski of NASA says is pulling from outside the edge of the universe. This is different from dark matter?
Well, it's beyond – astronomers love calling things dark because it makes it sound mysterious. It's great for getting
– It's because we can't see them.
Exactly. it's why they – it's why astronomers mostly look out at night. Calling it the dark flow is really just a way of saying there's something out there, something big that's pulling on a bunch of galaxies and we can't see it. We don't know what it is. Now, the thing that's really exciting here, the thing that's really baffling here is – whatever this thing is that's pulling on these galaxies appears to lie on the other side of the visible edge of the universe. So you could say this is the first indication of another universe or another part of the universe that we've never seen
before. Which has its own gravitational pull?
Which has something creating a gravitational pull. And that's – again, that's part of what's so exciting about it is all we know about it is there's something there pulling. It could be a whole other part of the universe. It could be a whole set of galaxies. We don't even know what it is. So dark is just sort of a way of saying – ignorance. We're ignorant of what it is, but we're seeing beyond another limit of that everyone said you would never see beyond.
Well, we're seeing so much more also because we have better telescopes and we have telescopes in space. Why are results from the Kepler telescope being withheld until February? deep dark matter secret?
Largely it's politics.
We're waiting until the Republicans take over Congress?
Yes. That was planned long enough ago that I can't quite make a conspiracy theory around that, but that's an interesting one. It's mostly, astronomy is probably one of the least political of all the fields of science because it's collaborative and publicly funded. But even this is a huge NASA project. There are a lot of different international teams involved, and even though almost everyone in the field knows the results, they're not actually allowed to discuss them until February because everybody has to get down and get together, make nice, agree on who's going to report what before it gets an official public airing.
Do we have any idea of what we're going to find out?
I think I'm allowed to tell you.
A member of NASA.
I'm not a member of
anymore.
NASA. I'm a member of the Fifth Estate. So basically, Kepler is a telescope that stares at one patch of the sky for a very long period of time with very, very sensitive digital detectors, and it looks for essentially the shadows of planets passing in front of those stars. By looking at hundreds of thousands of stars all at once, it can do a kind of search that a human eye could never do. The release that's going to come out in February is going to announce a few hundred Earth-like planets. And that doesn't mean – Earth-like planets means roughly the size of Earth. It doesn't mean that they would actually – it's not a place where you'd actually want to go and take a vacation. But what it means is we now have a sample of not just one or two but hundreds of places that are available for further study to say are any of these places not just sort of roughly the size of the Earth but actually have conditions that are like what we have here.
I heard that one of the planets has a carbon atmosphere. Which either suggests, as somebody pointed out, that you could probably find diamonds as easily as there are rocks here. Or my thinking is that they were way ahead of us and they've been driving cars for a lot longer time.
Yes, we'll find a planet that's completely and totally coated in SUVs.
What Los Angeles could have been if they hadn't changed some of the laws there. My guest is Corey Powell, who is the editor-in-chief of Discover Magazine. We're talking about the top 100 science stories of 2010. Obviously, we're not going to get to all of them, but we'll try to get to a lot more after we take a little break. We're back with Corey Powell, editor-in-chief of Discover Magazine. The current issue lists the top 100 science stories of 2010, and there are also some incredible images. The stories about astronomy and space are accompanied by these spectacular pictures. Would they be as interesting if we didn't have the pictures?
Well, no. I think the mental imagery is wonderful, but there's nothing that matches actually being able to see. And certainly one of the most extraordinary stories in astronomy of the past 20 years or so has been the development of new instruments that expand the range of human vision, not just in distance, but basically giving you X-ray eyes or ultraviolet eyes.
And you've published a huge image of the universe from 13.7 billion years ago. Is this a replication made from available data?
So in this case, this is looking at the universe in microwave eyes. This is if you're tuned to the microwave band, it's actually roughly the UHF band of your television. If anyone here is old enough to remember UHF, and when you look at the sky at that particular wavelength, what you see is you look past all the stars, look past all the galaxies, you look all the way out to the edge of the universe, and you see the afterglow of the Big Bang. And every time I look at that, that just boggles my mind that such a thing is possible. But there it is. There's a snapshot of what the universe looked like when it was 380,000 years old, 13.7 billion years ago.
And we heard it first. Anna Penzias was a guest on the show many years ago. He's the man who heard the first echo of the Big Bang. And then we were able, when we started sending telescopes into space, to actually see that glow?
Exactly. Right, you normally think of radio as something that you listen to, but you know, if you have an old TV set and you turn it to an empty UHF station, which is now pretty much all of them, the snow that you see on the TV, most of that snow is actually the signal that is the song of the universe. That's the remnant radiation of the Big Bang. We can map it, we can visualize it, and you actually get a picture of, you know, here's where the lumps were that made galaxies, that made planets, that made people.
We're talking about all of these advances, but it's my sense that manned spaceflight is being left to private entrepreneurs. Will Robert Bigelow, the hotel magnate, actually be sending people into space in low-cost spacecraft? Southwest Airlines?
he thinks so. He's been hyping this for a number of years. And you know, this year we did an interview with him because the project seems much, much closer to reality than it had been, and for two reasons. I mean, part of it is that entrepreneurial money really is moving into space and space exploration and space tourism. It looks like that's close to becoming a reality in the next couple of years. And the flip side of it is that NASA, for the near term, is out of the manned space program, and who knows if they'll ever get back in. So for the time being, it's the Russians, it's the Chinese, and it's the private entrepreneurs here in the United States.
You acknowledge that global warming has lost popular credibility this year because of the release of those emails and correspondence that seemed to say that scientists were exaggerating their data. Has the science behind climate change been discredited?
Well, no. I mean, what happened is, I would say, I mean, there were a handful of scientists who were very incautious, and especially, you know, when they thought they were just talking to each other privately, they were very incautious in how they described their data, how they described their research. You know, the fact that scientists are sometimes, you know, sloppy and loose and angry and political in how they talk to each other shows that they're human beings like the rest of us. But
WikiLeaks has shown that diplomats do the same sort of thing.
Remarkably, I'll bet if you heard journalists talking to each other, you would hear some
not
unsavory
us.
Things, possibly.
I'm politically correct at all times.
But, this is one of the stories where you have to just kind of separate the personality from the science. And, you know, if you go back and look at the data, there were five separate investigations and they found there was no actual scientific misconduct. What there was, you know, a lot of people who have egos and political agendas on top of the science that they do.
But there was a bit of exaggeration, wasn't there? Isn't one of your other stories about the fact that it's not human activity alone that is causing mountain ice to disappear?
Well, yes, and I think this has been a sort of a chronic problem in climate reporting, which is that there is such a strong political agenda wanting to deny or brush aside the research into climate change that, you know, some climate researchers have gone sort of in the other direction. They downplay the uncertainties because out of fear that, you know, any statement of scientific uncertainty is red meat to the other side. Well, you know, from a human perspective, that's understandable. But from a scientific perspective, you know, it ends up undercutting your case.
Well, why do you think there are still people who are trying to prove that these things are not true, or that evolution is not true, or that there was no Big Bang?
Well, look, I think, you know, it's always a question, you know, it's the old joke, you know, when a crime has been committed, you know, the first thing you do is you see, you know, who benefits from it. Well, you know, why do people deny these things? I think it falls into two general categories. I mean, there are people who have very strong economic interests in denying these things. But I think, you know, even more, there are people who have very strong personal interests. They feel that that you know, acknowledging climate change means our lifestyle is under assault. That the American standard of living is under assault. That the government is going to come in and scold you about how to live your life. And to a lot of people, that's a very upsetting prospect. It's much easier to think, oh, it's all not true. We don't need to worry about it.
Two of the stories that we covered a lot over the last few years have involved bedbugs and the disappearance of bats. Why are bedbugs grown so difficult to eradicate, while bats seem to be so vulnerable?
Well, so the most interesting thing about the bedbug story is that nobody knows why they're here. I mean, we know why they're here in the general sense, but why they're making a comeback right now is actually pretty much of a mystery.
Because it could have been 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Right. I mean, the common hand-waving explanation is that you know, we used to spray a lot of DDT, and DDT was very good at wiping out all kinds of pests. But of course, the spraying with DDT pretty much stopped in the early 70s. So, you know, here we are. You know, almost 40 years later, well, it doesn't take bedbugs 40 years to invade. What have they been doing for the last 40 years? Nobody knows. Here's a mystery that's literally like right under your head.
Also interesting, we're discovering species that are on the brink of extinction. We didn't know they existed, and now we're worrying that they're not going to exist.
Right. And you'll be seeing more and more of this. You know, the parts of the world where you can find new species are generally they're the last bits of wilderness.
Oh, so it was just Papua New Guinea, and that was it.
It's true. Southeast Asia is where a lot of the new species, and we're talking about, you know, large, beautiful things. We're not talking about, you know, viruses and bacteria, which, sad to say, nobody really cares about. But you know, the parts of the world where you can find these things are also parts of the world where the wilderness is threatened. So, as you say, you know, almost the second that you find them, these new species are also often on the way out.
My guest is Corey Powell, who is the editor-in-chief of Discover Magazine. They compiled a list of the 100 science stories, most important ones, of 2010. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A few years ago, I had a scientist assure me that humans and Neanderthals never interbred, and now we hear that they did, and humans also interbred with a new group that we didn't even know existed until just recently when we discovered some bones in a cave?
Right. This is a whole new human species called a Homo sediba, which is found in a cave in Siberia. So, yeah, I think there are two lessons here. One is, when you're dealing with something as uncertain as human evolution, don't believe a scientist when he says, oh, I know what went on. A certain level of skepticism is a healthy thing. And the other lesson, of course, is that we're a very loving species, we humans. And if there's somebody to share that love with, we will find a way to do so.
But that means also that the whole idea of a species being unique to itself isn't totally true. If we could interbreed with Neanderthals, if we could interbreed with another group that was like Neanderthal, but neither of them really human, that would suggest that, I'm not exactly sure what it suggests,
right.
I always thought that there was that you had to be uniquely specific about interbreeding.
Well, it tells you that the idea of species is a somewhat artificial construction. It's very useful for teaching biology. It's very useful for classification, but you know, human classification and the way nature works don't necessarily dovetail. I'll tell you the thing that really shocked me a couple of years ago. I was talking about this with an anthropologist, and I said, "Well, what about humans and chimpanzees? Could a human breed with a chimp?" And he said, "Oh, I don't know. Maybe they could." I said, "What?" He said, "Yes. Nobody's actually done the experiment, of course, because the ethics are terrible. But it's possible that a human and a chimpanzee could produce a viable offspring." So. if anyone knows of that experiment, definitely contact me immediately.
Well, why is the world's first cyber weapon, and how was it deployed?
So, yes, well, there we go. Sort of a swing back into the practical and grimmer side of things. This is the so-called Stuxnet worm. It's the technical term for it. It's not technically a virus, but a self-replicating computer program called a worm. This is a piece of malicious software that most notably hit heavy equipment in Iran, and the speculation is that it was released as a deliberate weapon to damage or destroy centrifuges in the Iranian nuclear weapons program. Again, the alleged Iranian nuclear weapons program, if we want to be careful here. The most interesting—
Well, it's alleged, but it seems to be working.
Right. the thing that's really interesting here is this is the first known instance of a piece of computer software that's designed not to destroy data, not to affect other software, but actually to affect hardware. It's a sort of a weapon that reaches out from the virtual world into the physical world. And if the software works correctly, and there's some pretty good indications that it did, what it does is it basically reprograms your heavy machinery to spin out of control and destroy itself.
And that would suggest that this kind of thing could be used in a lot of different applications.
Absolutely. It's one of those instances in which
is scary.
Right. Once there's one example that works, then everybody takes notice and thinks, well, if it works once, obviously you can do it 100 times, you can do it 1,000 times.
Now, one of the stories involves boulders that move by themselves across ground. Is this anything like the movement of gypsum dunes at the White Sands National Park?
The physical mechanism is quite different, but the basic meaning of it is actually very similar. What it tells you is, very small changes in temperature, precipitation, and wind can do really dramatic things. And this is one of the reasons the natural world is so beautiful, is that it just, these small inputs, give them enough time and they'll do remarkable things. In the case of the boulders, these boulders out in the desert that leave these long trails behind them, inexplicable how these things could move until researchers basically sat down, they camped out, watched what happened, and they did simulations that when there's a light rain, basically a little collar, almost like a little inner tube, forms around the edge of the boulder. Then it levitates on the rain and just takes a little bit of wind, and you get these amazing, inexplicable patterns right in the middle of the desert.
One of my producers finds something else inexplicable. She says she's played Rubik's Cube for years and made hundreds of moves and never came close to a 6-solid-side solution. But you say that mathematically the cube, regardless of the starting position, is never more than 20 moves away from that.
It has been mathematically proven that you can, in 20 moves, you can solve any configuration of a Rubik's Cube. The problem is knowing what those 20 moves are. And that's there are 43 quintillion possible starting positions. It's a number that's, I don't know about you, but it's a little bit larger than my brain can process. And so it's the problem is getting from 43 quintillion to one. But you can do it in 20 moves.
And there are people who understand the secret to Rubik's Cube, unlike most of us who just simply keep on moving the stuff around.
Well, I certainly would hope that if there's somebody out there who knows the secret to the Rubik's Cube, that he or she would apply that knowledge to something perhaps a little bit more practical.
Aren't you featured on Eminem's hip-hop radio's show called Shade 45 on Sirius?
Yes, I have appeared on that a number of times.
So science is really cool. We have objective proof of that. Your segment is called Learn Some, and we can't say the word on
right,
the air because they say learn some stuff.
Yes, learn something scatological.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's FCC approved.
And do your segments have topics? Do you take call-ins?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. It's heavily a call-in show, and so
what do hip hoppers want to know about science?
Well, so this was interesting. I went through exactly this process of all the things that seemed interesting in the articles to me, and the things that really connected with that audience were actually things related to brain and behavior. People really wanted to know things like, why do I cheat on my girlfriend? Is it possible to erase a bad memory because there's some terrible scatological term stuff that happened to me and I'd like to forget about it? Medical things and especially brain and behavior things really, really resonated with that audience, which was interesting to me.
You also do stuff on Fox News. I'm sure you get very different questions there. But do you get a lot of street cred for being with Eminem? People recognize you on the street?
Well, as they say, he's got a great voice for radio. On the radio, nobody knows what you look like. And I've been told that I don't look like my voice, so I'm not sure what that means. Mm-hmm. But I can't say that I've received any street cred for that. But I have to tell you, the producers there love science, and they were actually very, very enthusiastic about having a Discover editor on there, which I found really gratifying.
A caller wants to quibble with you about your idea that the definition of what a species is murky, and using the possibility that a chimp and human could reproduce and generate viable offspring as evidence of the idea that a species definition is fleeting. Species definition requires two organisms can reproduce and have offspring, and those offspring could reproduce as well. So, in other words, not a burro, mm-hmm. a mule, whatever. They'd have a viable, fertile offspring. We don't know whether that would happen with chimps, right?
Right. I mean, first of all, we don't know. I mean, second of all, broadly speaking, that's true. I mean, there are some pretty well defined categories, definitions of species that have been durable, but especially now, as people are trying to fine tune conservation efforts and trying to understand subspecies, there's a lot of murkiness there.
Corey Powell is editor-in-chief of Discover Magazine. We've been talking about Discover Magazine's 100 Science Stories of 2010. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's always fun. Lists are wonderful things.